He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls. You don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. As promised, these next few episodes will be a wild ride, as it's covering a fairly unknown case that has only recently began receiving media attention on a large scale. But this church is still dangerously thriving. Most of this research is from the brilliantly written and well-researched book, Broken Faith, Inside One of America's Most Dangerous Cults, written by Pulitzer Prize winner and New York Times bestseller Mitch Weiss and award-winning investigative journalist Holbrook Moore. Also, from the brave work of former member and survivor John Huddle's blog, religiouscultsinfo.org, and additionally, multiple articles by AP and former accounts of former members, including John Cooper, Daniel Cortez, Christina Bryant, Matthew Fenner, Michael Lowry. I didn't speak to all of the survivors personally, but they've put their story out there for us to hear, and they deserve to be heard. A family gathers, reunited after son and brother Darren Lloyd returns from an overseas U.S. Air Force job. Darren Lloyd's first stop? Visit his father Harold and mother, who had moved to Spindale, North Carolina in 1994, to join an exciting church, the Word of Faith Fellowship, with its bewitching leader Jane Whaley at the helm. Like Harold, many are drawn here, apparently called by Jesus, so they pack up and they leave their old lives behind, searching for something more. Darren was thrilled to see his father, as Harold had been struggling with heart problems off and on. When he arrived, he found his father and mother were living in a communal home with other members of the church. Odd, but Darren had been overseas for a while, so maybe he was just caught off guard, not used to their new lifestyle yet. I mean, clearly other members of his family also enjoyed the church, as his sister and her boyfriend, a church minister there, were also members and advocates for the Word of Faith Fellowship Church. Brush it off, Darren may have thought. They were all together, on an outing as a family. Suddenly, though, Harold wasn't feeling well. "Take hold," Darren's sister's boyfriend said. "It's in God's hands." "Huh? What is happening?" Darren may have thought. But Harold felt so weak that they had to bring him home. He sat at the kitchen table and then suddenly slumped over in his chair and said, "I'm having a heart attack." In a surreal display, Darren watched his mother, sister, and her boyfriend lay their hands on his father as they began screaming at the top of their lungs, "Get out, you evil spirits!" Darren, aghast by what he was witnessing, yelled in urgency, "Get him his medicine!" But the others kept blasting Harold. Blasting is a form of prayer, and I use that term extremely loosely, that was developed by the subject of our case, Jane Whaley, to basically cure all sin, ailments, unpure thoughts, etc. And it sounds like this. Imagine having a heart attack, and this is what is being screamed in your face? But they wouldn't stop. The three, almost in unison, fixated on Darren and demanded that he leave. Darren then ran to get his wife, who was also visiting, but had been napping. She knew CPR, so Darren woke her. "Get up," he said. They raced back to the kitchen where his dad was sweating and turning purple. Then Darren watched in horror as his father's eyes helplessly rolled back into his head, while his mother, sister, and her boyfriend continued to scream at the ailing man. Darren's father began to convulse and then slid out of his chair. Darren's wife forced her way into giving his father CPR as Darren went to call 911, but his mom and sister wouldn't let him as they had started dialing every elder in the church list, summoning them to come and blast for his father. Finally, someone ran next door and called for an ambulance, but it was too late. His father, Harold Lloyd, was dead. But the damage wasn't only done that night. Maybe they could have saved him by getting him help sooner, by not screaming into the desperately sick man's face, by not being so brainwashed by Jane Whaley that they believed it was the devil in him and not a simple act of health and science. The man had suffered from heart problems for years. Years before he joined the church. 2 weeks prior, he was told to immediately stop taking his vital heart medicine and instead needed to embark on a spirit-led healing prescribed by the church. A spirit-led healing that killed him. It was said that manslaughter could have been charged in Harold Lloyd's death. But the church was just too strong and too well-connected. And even more unnerving, its leader had no remorse and no shame. Jane Whaley spoke for an hour at Harold's memorial, likely making it about her, but I wasn't there and neither were you. So in this 3-part series on Jane Whaley and the Word of Faith Fellowship, I'll present all of the evidence I've found pointing to what I believe is an extremely dangerous and abusive cult. But I'll let you decide at the end of this where you come out on Jane Whaley's wrath. One thing I can tell you is that I'd rather have what Jane Whaley deems as devils inside me than let that helmet head of a woman anywhere near me or my family. Listen, I never promised there wouldn't be a few jabs here and there, because someone who could be systematically ruining the lives of thousands of people doesn't just get to skate along with their wrath unquestioned. Wrath. Jane Whaley's deadliest sin can be described as the uncontrolled hatred for someone or something and the unquenchable desire to exact revenge on said object or person. The wrathful person feels he or she must seek retribution on the focus of their anger and is usually so consumed by rage that they usually cannot calm down after their revenge is complete. Sure, that definition might make sense if the wrathful person is responding to someone harming or even killing their loved one. You may even be able to sympathize with that person. But where in the hell did Jane Whaley's wrath come from? Because she directed her wrath-fueled fury on the most naive and faultless. Children who simply laughed, babies who naturally cried, and adults who were just trying to get by in their day-to-day lives. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, Jane Whaley could be accused of the ultimate form of wrath, in which they say that the act of anger becomes a sin of wrath when it is directed against an innocent person, when it is unduly strong or long-lasting, or when it desires excessive punishment. Quote, if anger reaches the point of a deliberate desire to kill or seriously wound a neighbor, it is gravely against charity. It is a mortal sin. Jane Whaley inflicted wrath upon people who would never, ever turn around and give that treatment back to her. Though she might like you to believe that she is the victim, and she spends countless hours posting on the Word of Faith Fellowship website trying to prove she's just a wholesome, helpful grandmother.
God warns us that in the last days, there will be evil men that will rise up against God. It says that these evil men will hate God and they will speak slanderous and false accusations against God's people. We at the Word of Faith Fellowship are seeing this verse come to pass firsthand. I personally do not know of any other church that has had so many lies, so much false accusations against a church other than the Word of Faith Fellowship. There is a group of people that have banded themselves together, and they have stated that their mission is to shut our doors. These people run to the media. They run to any reporter that will hear their story. They go to law enforcement, and they tell these agencies false reports about us. And they use all of these to spread their lies against us. And recently, we have had many lies in the newspaper, in the media. And these lies have been ludicrous. You may have heard some of these lies. We at the Word of Faith Fellowship want you to know the truth. Congregants of the Word of Faith Fellowship were regularly punched, smacked, choked, slammed to the floor, or thrown through walls in a violent form of deliverance meant to purify sinners by beating out devils. Lies. Lies. A recent lie. The lie. Another lie is that this church actually takes all of our money, that our pastors, Sam and Jane Whaley, are some of the most giving people I know. They want everybody to lie to authorities, to lie to government agencies. Another lie, the lie goes like this, that liars will burn in hell.
Well, tonight I'm really grateful for everything God's done for me. And I've been here since preschool. But when I was in fifth grade, my life really changed. My mom had a sister who lived in Florida, and she was a crack addict. She was very abusive. She was a person full of hate. And she decided she wanted help, and my family and our church took her in. And she decided she wanted help for a little bit, and then she decided she didn't. She wanted to go back to her old lifestyle. And she attacked our school. She attacked the ministers in our church. She attacked grandmother and granddad, who we just love so dearly. And she just attacked everybody. And everything she said was a lie. We've never been abused in this church. We've never been beaten. The DSS came in and they asked us, you know, all these questions. And we were like, that's never happened. We've never been abused. All we do is love. And I was just like, we've never been abused in this church. We've never been beaten. And I decided I was serving Jesus, and that was the best decision I ever
made. The grandmother and granddad Danielle is referring to is Jane Whaley and her husband Sam. Not grandparents by blood, just their preferred way of being referred to within the church. And the crack addict she's referring to? Well, you'll hear her story in part two. This so-called crack addict was a loving mom who had issues. It's a human condition. And Danielle, the teenager's voice you'll hear in that clip, went on to escape the church and would later speak out about the abuse and brainwashing, and is now working to help others get freedom and justice. The fact is, the victims of Jane's brutal mistreatment and abuse don't even respond to her with anywhere near close to the wrath she inflicted upon them for stepping outside her ever-changing rules. But Jane Whaley's rules can be thrown out, because the content of those rules have nothing to do with what her ultimate goal was: to completely rule and dominate over the lives of thousands in order to feed her addiction for control. Like an addict craves a drug, Jane Whaley craved power. Currently, Jane Whaley is 80 years old. She's flashy. She frames her angry face with hair that seems almost purposely shaped into bold parentheses meant to emphasize her anger. Two large aqua-netted curls that look like they were formed by hot rollers the size of a Costco-sized coffee can. A look she encouraged her followers to also adopt. She wears St. John suits, tons of jewelry, and looks like a 1980s poster woman for the working gals movement. But she's not the head of Red Book magazine or the CEO of Sears. She is an evangelical oppressor with no formal theological training, just the incessant need to manipulate and control people to fill the void of what would have been an average existence. Not particularly funny or pretty or charismatic, she rules with a shrill scream that systematically beats people into submission. Yet, Jane Whaley portrays herself as a perpetual victim, likening her religious persecution and attacks by the outsiders, including the Inside Edition expose and former members' firsthand brutal accounts, to the Holocaust. Yes, you heard me correctly. I didn't stutter. Jane Whaley believes that she can relate to the 6 million Jews that were murdered at the hands of a tyrannical monster to her being questioned by people who consider her to be the tyrant. The irony is almost laughable. So who is Jane Whaley, and how did she pull this off? Jane Whaley was born Margaret Jane Brock on October 22, 1939. She grew up in a small Baptist town in North Carolina at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains. She came from a religious family and had two brothers. Her mother was a homemaker, and her father owned a plumbing supply company. She was the middle child and was described as quiet and painfully shy when she was young. She was tiny and later would describe herself as a homely kid. But she gained confidence from being a daddy's girl and loved hanging around his shop, hearing the stories of her father and other customers. She eventually joined the soccer team and swim team before attending college. From all accounts, she had a perfectly normal upbringing. At college, she studied to be a teacher and eventually taught math before meeting and marrying Sam Whaley, a used car salesman. Sam talked about his religious beliefs early on in their dating, and she decided that wherever he was going, she would be too. They married after only 6 months of meeting, and after they had their first and only daughter, Robin. Jane left teaching to become a stay-at-home mom and was described as motherly in her early years. Soon after, they moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, the epicenter of the televangelist movement, home to other charismatic scammers like Robert Tilton and Oral Roberts. But Jane didn't initially fit in. She was made fun of by the over-the-top, flashy wives of the TV preachers there. These wives were creating their own ministries. They flew into Tulsa on private jets. They wore expensive furs, gold, and diamonds. Jane felt like she had a hick accent and bad teeth, and these women looked down on her. It said she wanted to be like them, but I believe she wanted to beat them at their own game. Jane didn't want to be just another flashy minister's wife. She wanted to be the minister. But her husband Sam was still the one called to be there at this point. He studied at Hagen's Bible School, which was the cutting edge of the fundamentalist charismatic movement. Founded by Kenneth Hagin, the original pioneer of the Word of Faith movement. And as Sam studied, Jane did too. No, not formally, but she kept copious notes on what Sam was learning and what the church was preaching, building her arsenal of tools to eventually get back at those who looked down upon her. She began to form her own opinions and beliefs on the Bible and the prosperity gospel. And I use the words opinions and beliefs loosely because, as you'll see later on, Jane may or may not have believed her own BS, but she certainly knew how to use those ideas to bend people toward her will. She, like all good evangelical scam artists, and there are many good ones out there, don't get me wrong, knew how to peruse the Bible and find verses and scriptures to justify their actions. Listen, if you want people to give you more money, find a passage about followers living in poverty to serve the Lord, but preach it to mean something like this. You're meant to live simply until all your devils have been cleansed, and you will be rewarded tenfold in this life and in the house of the Lord after you give your money in the name of your sin. Confess your sin through your tithe, and then only then will you be forgiven and rewarded with abundance and riches. Now pass that tithe and play it around and wash your sins by emptying your wallets. I'll hand them over to God for you, and he will cleanse you of your devils, and you will live amongst God's other richly rewarded servants just like me. I legitimately just made up that in 30 seconds. That whole rant. Because after researching so many of these fools, it's not that hard to follow their roadmap of manipulation. But please, keep your money. You earned it. After studying, Sam became a staff preacher at Rhema Ministries under the guidance of Kenneth Hagin. Sam's job at Rhema was to travel the world and preach the prosperity gospel. Pray loud enough and God will answer your prayers. But while Sam was away, Jane, perhaps fueled by her bitterness towards being an outcast among the other evangelical wives, began to take control. She began performing her own deliverances and getting the devils out of people, and she had the personality for it. The once shy little girl loved the attention of people believing she was special. But it was more than that. She loved seeing that she could control others. Once a teacher to young students, it seems Jane was finding that teaching may have never left her. And I'm not talking about your standard school teacher. Oh no. After Kenneth Hagin caught wind of what Jane, never formally trained in ministry and never ordained, was doing, he told Sam to either get his wife in line or get out. But Sam was also falling prey to Jane's control. He couldn't stand up to her, and he gave up his own ministry, saying that God had now called Jane to be a preacher, and he began to cower to her every demand. They left Tulsa in 1979 with just over 20 loyal believers and moved to Rutherfordton, North Carolina. And unbeknownst to the loyal that followed, and likely Sam, Jane would eventually become one of the most dangerous false prophets to ever reign over a Christian church. Jane Whaley's curriculum implores you to become literate in your personal shame, to develop skills in denial, and to eventually graduate completely brainwashed. Because Jane Whaley's church is not a church at all. It has all the makings of a bona fide cult, a physically and mentally abusive cult, with more followers than David Koresh and Jim Jones combined, and with no signs of slowing down. Jane Whaley's evolution to what she is today started out small. She first started to appeal to women struggling in life, holding small meetings and framing herself as a confidant for women who were carrying a lot of shame about their sexuality, alcohol, or substance misuse, or with marriages that were falling apart. Jane made them feel that God loved them, and she could help them get closer to God. The next step was a complete makeover to be the aspirational figure she was claiming to be, a woman of money, class, and sophistication. She got her teeth fixed, ditched her self-described hick accent, and stood in front of the mirror practicing enunciation and eloquent speaking. She began wearing expensive clothes that she got from thrifting, and which would become a major part of the way she hooked people in, gifting them during Sunday sermons with shoes, scarves, classy jackets that God put upon her to give to them. And she picked up on the theatrics of other evangelical leaders, but added her own shrill to it. Now, I'm not saying just because she's a woman it's shrill. It's because she seems to unhinge her jaw and come up with a scream that makes Joan Crawford's Mommy Dearest sound like a nursery rhyme. And this scream, we will soon learn, is called blasting. It's her brand of occult tactic that hooks her followers in. She beats them down before building them up. She shows interest, becomes an icon they look up to as she bestows care and gifts and guidance upon them. Oftentimes people come there because they were lost, broke, or insecure, and Jane made them feel like they too could have the good life that she had. And that's exactly what sucked the Cooper family in. After all my research, the Cooper family seemed to be the best conduit into the world of Jane Whaley, as they show through their nuclear family, extended family, escapees, and ones that were never members of Word of Faith Fellowship, What happens when Jane Whaley takes hold? Rick Cooper believed in devils and deliverance long before he joined Word of Faith Fellowship with his wife, Suzanne, and their six children in September of 1993. He dreamed of spiritual camaraderie and listened intently to various teachings on tactics to battle spiritual warfare. Years before the move to Spindle, North Carolina, that would change the lives of the Cooper family forever, Rick was a sailor on a nuclear submarine. He and Suzanne moved a lot, usually after a baby arrived. The young family had lived all over the country and all over the world. Once Rick retired, the family settled in Darien, Georgia. Susan loved it there. Rick believed he had a calling and began preaching at the Christian Life non-denominational church in town. Parishioners loved the earnest family man and thought he was the type of pastor they could build a church around. To Susan's delight, the church made an offer for Rick to become a full-time pastor. But he turned it down, and Susan was horrified. They had no savings, no money. They lived paycheck to paycheck. Though she had served in the Air Force, she couldn't work now. She needed to be home raising their children and knew that Rick's $1,200 a month Navy pension would not cover their bills. She wanted to move to Florida to be closer to her family and her mother, Wanda, but Rick had other plans. Rick's mother, Cora, had attended the Word of Faith Church for 10 years. When the Coopers visited Cora over the span of time, they would attend Word of Faith with her. They were always showered with love by the congregation. Rick thought perhaps Jane Whaley could enlighten his faith and help launch his career, though he found the services and noise commotion to be a bit much at the time. Eventually, he saw what church members worked hard to portray: happy parishioners who were bonded in helping each other get rid of oppressors. Rick began to see Jane as a heroic figure, and he was impressed. However, some of the techniques used at Word of Faith made Rick's church members back home feel uncomfortable. They did not like the rituals of blasting or the ongoing exorcism. If Rick accepted their offer to lead the flock, he couldn't practice such methods. And so, Rick declined the position and packed his family up and moved in with his mother to take classes at Word of Faith. The move to his mother's house was, as promised, temporary. But Suzanne was skeptical and uncomfortable with so many kids living in a tiny house with Rick's mom. But Rick said as soon as he got his degree, he would find a job as a pastor in a town of her choice. Susan's mother, Wanda, was worried. She wanted her daughter and grandchildren to move to Florida and let Rick go to Bible school. But Suzanne followed her husband as she always did, wondering how expensive the schooling would be and how he could support them all. But there, living close to the compound of the Word of Faith Church, the Coopers were soon knee-deep in Word of Faith's world of worship services, parent meetings, Christian school and nursery duties, weddings, fellowship dinners, and the goal of getting into Jane's inner circle. They seemed so happy and affluent there. Yet, it only took a short time for Suzanne to realize she was pregnant once again, causing Rick to set aside his plans to pursue Bible school. He needed a job, so church leaders offered him a gig at their construction company. And he was satisfied with that, as he saw living life at Word of Faith and being involved in the lives of congregants as an education in and of itself. He went to every study he could amongst the church's 500 members at the time. To Rick, the church was becoming a community. He felt like he was on the ground floor of something spectacular. Susan, on the other hand, was a harder sell, especially after the family officially joined the church, when the congregants held an exorcism ritual on her young son, John David, to cast the demons from the boy. For 10 excruciating minutes, members laid their hands on him and held him down and began blasting him, yelling in his face to cast out evil spirits. but Jane Whaley was hard at work with her southern charm, doing her best to make Suzanne see past her skepticism and see the good the church could offer. Jane took special interest in Suzanne, often telling her how much she loved their family. When Suzanne's baby Blair was born, Jane made sure the Coopers had everything they could possibly need. Meals, cleaning, babysitting. Jane even visited Suzanne in the hospital. When Jane praised Suzanne, she began to believe what Rick always had said about God being good. She began giving back her time to the congregation, volunteering to help other new moms in the same way she was helped. By early 1994, Suzanne was hopeful, happy. Wanda, her mother, traveled from Florida to meet her new grandson and was worried about the daughter she found upon arrival. There was no longer the usual lighthearted conversation, no more gossip or talking about Rick. Suzanne only wanted to talk about Jane and Word of Faith. Wanda wanted to experience a church service firsthand, so she attended a service. At the beginning was when Jane started auctioning off her thrift items, clothing given to the congregants to look wealthy, successful members of the church, which simultaneously made them feel special and taken care of by Jane. But Wanda saw right through that and likened it to a home shopping network experience. And when she confronted Suzanne, she defended Jane. Suzanne said Jane just wanted them to look nice. Then Wanda noticed that the sermons were more public shaming than scripture. And it appeared Jane was treated more like a movie star or prophet, and Wanda felt evil in the room. When she mentioned this to her daughter, Suzanne replied that the kids were doing great and getting a solid education. There was no telling her otherwise. As Wanda drove back to Florida, she was struck with a horrible thought. Could Word of Faith Fellowship actually be some sort of doomsday cult? As the world's premier streaming service for horror, thriller, and supernatural content, Shudder is spooky 24/7, 365. And just because Halloween has come and passed doesn't mean that the scares don't continue. Sign up for Shudder and get access to the largest collection of acclaimed horror movies and series streamed right to your favorite devices. Shudder made my Halloween amazing. I carved pumpkins, I watched scary movies, I laughed, I cried, I just got scared mostly, but I did laugh because some of them are super funny, but also super spooky. But I'm not giving up on, you know, just because Halloween's done, I still want to be scared. I'm making dinner right now. Plans are afterwards. Turn on Shudder and watch Creepshow Animated Special, a Shudder original series, which is available now. Also, great titles like Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist. Oh, okay, I gotta watch that. Greg, I hope you're into it. That airs November 19th. Blood Vessel, November 5th. Scare Me, starring Josh Rubin, Aya Cash, and Chris Redd. What's up, Chris? Fellow comedian. That's available now. And The Mario Bava Collection, November 23rd. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $5.99 a month or $56.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest growing, human curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. It's the Netflix for horror. Yes, it is. There are new spine tingling thrillers, shocking horrors, and edge of your seat suspense added weekly. And you'll have unlimited access to stream ad free on all your favorite devices like your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, Xbox One, Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, Roku, and Android devices. And Shudder has a unique collection of exclusive and original films and series, horror classics, and blockbuster hits. They have international hits. They have old classics like Night of the Living Dead, which I'm kind of embarrassed I haven't seen before, but guess what I'm doing tonight? Night of the Living Dead. So, get started streaming the best horror, thriller, and supernatural content. Shudder's expertly curated collection includes titles like the acclaimed Tigers Are Not Afraid, One Cut of the Dead, Revenge and the Creepshow TV series produced by Greg Nicotero and based on the famous films by George Romero. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to shudder.com and use promo code SINNERS. That's Shudder. S-H-U-D-D-E-R, and use promo code SINNERS. Okay, guys, to try Shudder for free for 30 days. Go to shudder.com and use promo code SINNERS. Again, that's S-H-U-D-D-E-R. SINNERS is spelled S-I-N-N-E-R-S. Let's get spooky together. Rick's mother, Cora, was a different story. Though she was a member of the church, she was divorced and had a boyfriend who wasn't a congregant. She was a rebel with dyed black hair who would play the sweepstakes and sneak off to the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday nights. The more Rick got into the teachings of Word of Faith, the more he argued with his mother, Cora. His first blasting session left quite an impact on him. He began to accept their doctrine without question and accepted his punishments. Jane became a mother figure to him. He even began calling her mother. In order to move up the ranks in the ministry, Rick knew he had to deal with Cora's gambling and asked her to repent. When she refused, he called her a harlot. As the fighting grew louder and more frequent, Suzanne was worried for the children and spoke to an assistant pastor, saying if the fighting didn't end, she would leave Rick. Word of this got back to Jane, as everything did, and she asked to speak to the couple. To their surprise, she praised their attendance and hard work. She said they had proven their loyalty and it was time to take the next step. Only a handful of people were chosen to attend leadership meetings. The only stipulation was that Jane asked them to undergo marriage counseling with a minister to get their marriage back on track. Rick thought perhaps they could overcome their problems. He was so close to becoming part of the inner circle, part of the elite. The family had all the tools necessary, they thought, to forge ahead on this new path. They could not possibly have known what waited further down the road. But they were in. How exciting. Word of Faith's counseling services were far from traditional. Jane's pseudo-daughters, Brooke and Carol, women who she had deemed her foot soldiers and now so-called daughters, had no psychology credentials, but counseled the married couples that were referred to them by their mother. The Coopers fought over everything, especially money, and more specifically, Rick's propensity to make all the decisions. They also fought about sex. Rick always wanted sex. In their first counseling session, Suzanne surprised herself by how open she was, blurting out all their problems. Rick's need for sex. She opened up to Brooke and Carol about nearly everything. Hearing this, Rick knew he had to change or Suzanne would leave him. Suzanne always hated confrontation, but had no choice. If they wanted to become part of Word of Faith's inner circle, she needed to make a change, and so did Rick. Far before joining Word of Faith, when they were first dating, Suzanne was always unsure about Rick. Rick and Suzanne's first date took place after a Sunday evening church service. He told her on that first date he was going to marry her. Later, he testified at church that he would do everything in his power to make Suzanne love him. Feeling pressured, she told him in front of the congregation that she too would marry him, and they tied the knot later that week. Suzanne knew immediately, though, that she had made a mistake. But everything moved so quickly. She knew she didn't love him, but she was constantly getting pregnant. But as we all know, children are never enough to keep a marriage alive. She knew that. We know that. By the time the Cooper family made the move to North Carolina, Suzanne felt dead inside. It was like a weight on her shoulders that couldn't be lifted. But now, with Jane's help and support from the Word of Faith congregation, Susan felt hope for the first time in years. She felt alive again. And Rick seemed motivated. He had become laser-focused on completing work on the family homestead, a 4,800-square-foot space that he built himself, board by board. It had become a family project, bringing Rick closer to his children, especially the three eldest, who lent their sweat equity in measuring, cutting, and sanding. With the home under construction, the Coopers moved out of Cora's home into a cramped three-bedroom rental. Looking forward to this big new house, everything seemed okay. Until it was put upon by them by God that other members would be instructed to live there with them upon completion. Jane loved communal living and imposed it upon people because that way she could have eyes everywhere. And they were always encouraged to tell on each other and to tell Jane about the devils inside them. Still in the rental, though, as broke as ever, Suzanne felt nauseous. She knew without a doubt what this meant. She was pregnant. Again. Pregnant. Without discussing the plan with Jane first. Jane had told her congregants that they must run these decisions by her. Suzanne was devastated. But she had to suck it up because that day, she was to attend Jane's daughter Robin's bridal shower. A shower Suzanne knew was going to be like reliving a horrible popular high school kids' party where she was underdressed and unimpressive in the gift she could afford to give. She wished so bad she could go to Saks Fifth Avenue or any department store for that matter and impress Jane with her gift to Robin. But all she could afford was a practical gift. A sweet gift, in my opinion, but Suzanne felt like her nail file and brush and daily women's products were not enough. Suzanne pulled up to the lavish house with fancy cars parked outside and hoped to slide in unnoticed to the party, trying to forget her nausea and the impending doom of having to tell Jane about the pregnancy. As she watched Robin being given gift after gift, and Robin would acknowledge the gift and move on. At one point, a female guest leaned into Robin to admire the gift, enjoying the party and the excitement with Robin. Then, to everyone's horror, Jane began screaming at the top of her lungs to get away from her daughter. Never get that close. Then for 10 minutes, she continued to berate and humiliate the woman in front of everyone there. This was the first time Suzanne saw a terrible side of Jane. But too afraid of not being in her good graces, she, like everyone else at the party, never said a word. When Suzanne told Rick of the pregnancy, he of course welcomed the news. But Suzanne was petrified. She knew how Jane would react. They were still in marriage counseling, per Jane's request. Their relationship was far from perfect. And Jane was the one who was filling the emotional void in Suzanne's life, not Rick. She needed Jane's approval. Suzanne had grown accustomed to being under Jane's wing. She became used to the praise from the pulpit about her bright and obedient children being called role models. Jane was so nurturing to the Cooper family. What would this pregnancy do to that relationship? Suzanne knew the rules. Couples needed permission to have children. She and Rick heard that message time and time again. They were constantly reminded that they had too many children already. And in the eyes of the church, Suzanne's childbearing years were over years ago. Of course, Rick couldn't contain his joy, and he told the members of the congregation right away. He believed faith had carried them this far. But Suzanne kept the news quiet. She confided in Counselor Brooke, who in turn told Jane. Instructed to write a letter to Jane to explain what happened, Suzanne tried to reassure her mentor that she and Rick didn't plan to have another child. It just happened. She had grown to be happy about it, though, and believed it must have been a part of God's plan. Jane's response was harsh. She told Suzanne the baby was not in the spirit of God and preached it from the pulpit. When you hear from God and do things in the spirit of God, then your child will be provided for. With things like clothing and food. She reiterated, when you just go out and get pregnant, it's in sin. The more Jane pounded her truth from the pulpit, the more it cut through Suzanne like a knife. Jane accused them of only having babies to have babies. The snide comments were not confined to just the pregnancy. The Coopers found themselves being criticized on a myriad of things, especially their youngest toddler, Blair. Church leaders said there must be something wrong with the child because he wasn't peaceful. When Jane picked Blair up from the nursery one day and he started crying, Jane scolded Suzanne for the child's behavior and said the baby was not doing the will of God or holding on to Jesus. And so the congregants blasted the toddler. Suzanne lived for Jane's approval. She was ashamed and determined to get back in her mentor's good graces. Though she was feeling demoralized, she vowed to follow Jane's advice to raise her new baby. She questioned whether she might be a bad mother and was eager to learn how to raise children God's way, with Jane leading her down the right path. She even succumbed to more completely unregulated counseling by Jane's minions. This wouldn't be the last thing that weirded Suzanne out, but coupled with the scene at Jane's daughter's bridal shower and the public shaming of her pregnancy, it did make her start to question what the hell is going on here. From the beginning of Jane's rise to power, she had her followers confess the most intimate details of their lives. She even kept index cards of the collateral that she collected from them. Were women attracted to men? Were men attracted to children? Who spent too much money on worldly things like makeup? Who lusted after movie stars? Any issue Jane felt needed recorded was recorded and saved. It should come as no surprise that sexual desire was the worst sin of all. And as the years wore on, Jane clamped down tighter on the control of people's lives. Unmarried people weren't allowed to date. Most marriages were also now arranged by Jane, and married people had to run their sexual activities by Jane. Babies, as Suzanne found out, couldn't just be willy-nilly conceived. The new rules stated that if church leadership allowed lovemaking by married couples, it was limited to 30 minutes. No foreplay allowed, the lights needed to be turned off, and only missionary position was sanctioned. And all of your sexual thoughts and actions were disclosed to other married couples in sessions led by Jane and other church leaders. During one class, Jane pointed to a woman and said, "This one is lustful." Once, she also singled out a man who'd had a wet dream. When a man's hand was crushed while working on Whaley's garage door, Whaley told the church it was the judgment of God because he'd admitted to masturbating. In the summer of 2006, Jane called a special meeting about sexual activity. Carol Reynolds and Brooke Covington were the leaders of Suzanne's group. Neither had any formal sex education, therapy training, degrees of any such sort, but everyone was supposed to listen to them because they were Jane's minions. And all the while, Suzanne knew nothing could save her marriage. She and Rick hadn't had sex in more than a year, and she had no desire for intimacy, and she had been, as instructed, reporting Rick's unclean thoughts to Jane Whaley for months. Yet, when Carol announced that someone in the room was refusing to have sex with her husband, Susan knew her number was up. And in perhaps the most bizarre move by Jane's minions, this happened. "We're going to deal with that in this meeting. And this is how your sex should be. We're going to show you how God wants you to do it." Oh my God, Suzanne thought, as she watched Carol and Brooke embrace and rock back and forth, two middle-aged ladies in twin sets and pearls, simulating godly intercourse. "When you're together, you should cry out to God," Brooke said. With her eyes closed and her arms still around Reynolds, Brooke demonstrated. "Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus!" she said louder. But as they rocked faster and faster, Brooke's voice got louder and louder. "Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus!" until it sounded like she had reached an intense orgasm. Everyone was silent. After that, in my opinion, suppressed erotic display, Jane reminded everyone that they should hear from God before having sex. It couldn't be spontaneous. They'd still have to get approval. Intercourse was no different than going to the store and getting a loaf of bread. Something to put on your to-do list, get it over with, and move on. You weren't supposed to enjoy it. Well, it seems like Carol and Brooke enjoyed something in that moment, and so did Jane. Was it control? Was it, "See, I can get away with this and you can't"? Was it, everyone in the room besides Jane crying out for sexual freedom, family freedom, career freedom, freedom to do anything. The desperation was palpable. This concludes our first episode on the insane mind of Jane Whaley. Come back next week to hear more. It only gets more bizarre and terrifying. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you guys so much. And the best way you can support us if you enjoy the show is to leave 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and a positive review. It means the world to us. So also tell a friend. Connect with us on Instagram at 7 Deadly Sinners Podcast. Let us know where you're listening. Tag us in your Insta story. Thank you to Kate Codman, our new research and writing assistant. She has been such a breath of fresh air in this rabbit hole of researching these scumbags. 7 Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.